sleep in makes me feel guilty when I look around me and there are people that don't. And especially older people, you know.
That are being killed for our comforts or for the comforts of
those in
power.
Well, you know, once you're
killed,
you're dead, but to be living and to suffer, to me, hurts. To me, that's painful. You die, you're dead. But to live and suffer, I can't take it.
Yeah.
It's very, very disturbing.
Here's David Robick's take on an allied subject.
Tom Brokaw got on TV and repeated the big lie. See the mill all boarded up, hear the sympathetic sigh. He summed it up succinctly with these vicious words: it's your paycheck or your planet, the loggers of the birds. Pete Wilson and his cronies were nowhere to be found. They said big timber is our business, to the dollar we are bound. Their absence was a message, we'll turn a blinded eye. Don't expect us to give a damn if anyone should die. Charles Hurwitz told the nation, the battle lines are drawn. These eco-terrorists won't stop till all your jobs are gone. His PR team worked overtime to build up every wall. These bomb throwers and tree spikers just want to kill you all. A man stood at the chainsaw knowing only what he knew. And everything he learned said, it's either me or you. His saw lanced through the redwood, many hateful words he said, and several seconds later, David Chain was lying dead. Some will call this man a killer, some will call this man a thug, some will cover it in lies and try to sweep it beneath the rug. But from Oakland to Fortuna, Sacramento to DC, there is murder in the air, and there are killers running free. From Oakland to Fortuna, Sacramento to DC, there is murder in the air, and there are killers running free.
David Rovics from his album We Just Want the World, and the song is The Death of David Chain. You're tuned to Free Radio's 96.3 FM, or actually 96.3 FM's Free Radio. Anyway, you're tuned to both those things. And you can call in at 427-3772 if you want to talk with Anita and Robert. Maybe you can tell us where you get your herb from. You can tell us who you think the... I don't want to ask these... ditzy questions about the Metro's top 10 lists. But if you feel like that, of course, you can talk about that. We're going to be having Paul Sanford, a conversation with him in about 15 minutes. In fact, in preparation for that, I'm going to play a little bit from the discussions I had with Michael Newdow back in discussions, a brief interview I had with Michael Newdow back in January when he, I think it was January, might have been December, when he spoke before the Monterey Peninsula College of the Law, which is where there was a sort of a mock Supreme Court sitting. Newdow, you may remember, is the man who has gone to Washington and argued himself before the Supreme Court that the words "under God" should be struck from the Pledge of Allegiance because they are a violation of the First Amendment, which prohibits an establishment of religion. So...
what's your opinion on that, Robert?
I agree with him. I think the words "under God" were added. Well, I think it's historically clear that they were added in 1954 in response to anti-communist hysteria of that time, where you were trying to prove that we were all, patriotic as we could be, and part of that patriotism was expressing a sort of a Christian under
Godishness. God is not such a Christian thing. I'm a Jew. I believe in God.
I understand.
I don't think it matters what you call God. I'm disturbed by it. I want to see it left in.
But does God belong in government is the question. I think if you look through the entire Constitution, you don't find the word God. This was added. The founding people who wrote this, whatever their faults, and they were many, slave owners, misogynists, and so forth, people of their time, they had their heads on straight around issues of separation of church and state. They realized the kind of the corruption of both religion and government that happens when you mix these two things.
And I agree, but I don't see what that has to do with teaching children in school or Lions Clubs or Elks Lodges reciting the Pledge of Allegiance and saying...
Well, Elks Lodges are different than public schools. An Elks Lodge is a private organization. If the private organization wants to say under God, of course they can.
Well, I want to see a public organization say it too, especially the public schools.
And if a child wants to say under God in school, they can. It's just that teachers should not lead pledges with the phrase under God, which puts pressure on people to say under God.
They don't have to feel pressured. They don't have to say under God if they don't want to.
Hang on just a second. Okay, let's get this caller in, and then we'll... caller, you have any comments on the air with Anita and Robert?
Yeah, it'd be nice if Anita's mic was turned on.
Oh, I think it is. It's just not...
My mic is not on.
Oh.
Can you hear her now?
I can hear her over the phone.
I've turned it up slightly. It was on before, but...
Oh, thank you so much for letting
us. We don't really
know.
Want her mic on. We want her mic off and my mic on.
Yeah,
don't
we
mind,
know your
caller.
Methods there, Norse. Yeah.
Good morning, Miss Becky.
Hi, you're doing...
Good morning.
Wonderful to have you on the air, Anita.
Well, you know what? I'd like to see you sometime, Becky. I was just mentioning to Robert that maybe you and I would do well doing a show, and maybe we could talk about women's issues and this whole welfare reform and how that's affecting women. And, you know, I run into women every day who are having problems either because they're on the methadone program or they don't have a vehicle, and the county has just been brutal to them, and they've been cut off from their cash aid. Or food stamps. I'm also interested in what's going on over in Israel. I know you and I have some similar and probably... unpopular views. But I think it would be fun for you and I to get together and, you know, kind of shoot the breeze.
I think that'd be great. And you know that poverty is a women's issue in Santa Cruz County.
Yes.
Where the vast majority of single parents are women...
The overwhelming majority. I don't want to leave men out, but the overwhelming majority.
I think it's like something like 89%.
Yeah, it's high.
Becky, while you're on the line, I got a call from another activist, Bob Patton, who said that he had gotten a call from two homeless folks, Dirt Clod and Kay. You want to talk about them at all?
Well, they're... Still survivors from Camp Paradise. Dirt Clod was one of the co-founders of Camp Paradise years ago. We had a conversation with him a few weeks ago where he reported that since Camp Paradise has been disbanded, there have been four deaths down there, I think murders, if I'm not mistaken, in that area. Dirt Clod and his wife Kay, who is wheelchair bound, had been living in their van up until about 2 days ago when Officer Eric Seeley, who is the homeless resource officer for the Santa Cruz Police Department, seized their vehicle, which was not only their home but all their possessions.
And she is a wheelchair user?
And she's wheelchair bound.
Now, this is very bizarre.
Now, I should point out that they had been unable to get their vehicle street legal in terms of smog and current registration. And he had been somewhat lenient with them for a longer period of time than I would have expected.
Well, he's a wonderful guy, Eric Seeley, but wouldn't it have been nice if he pulled out $100 or $200 and gave them the funds they needed to get that into code so they would have a place to live rather than being patient and tolerant and kind for a little while, knowing they weren't going to be able to achieve that goal? I mean, if you don't have money on Monday to make the repair, you're not going to have the money the following Monday.
I am not sure why this couple with the woman who's so severely handicapped couldn't get some sort of aid to get into some sort of minimal housing here in Santa Cruz County.
Boy.
And I would have hoped that Eric Seeley, in his position as homeless resource officer...
Now, is this senior, Eric Seeley?
No, it's the younger.
Okay.
And that he would have special access to resources and be able to refer people to those resources rather than simply arrest in jail or seize vehicles. That certainly doesn't help homeless people at all in their survival.
Well, did they impound the vehicle?
Yes, they did.
So they more than likely will not be getting their vehicle back?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in addition to whatever expenses they would have with repair or smogging or licensing...
The impound fees.
The impound fees are extraordinary. And by the way, those are impound fees are all paid to the private towing company. Not a dime of that goes into public funds. I think that's a scandal in itself.
I think they're in bed with each other, the police and these tow company drivers. Sometimes I feel that way about the apartment complex I live in.
You're not criticizing our police department, I hope.
Rarely will I criticize the police department, but on occasion I do take issue.
Shocking.
I do know that North County Tow does not even deal with ordinary people anymore. It's so lucrative to just deal
with
police tickets and seizures and tows.
Becky, I'm under a time crunch, so let me ask you to... Is there more you need to say on this? Or should we...
No, I just called to say turn Anita's mic up, frankly.
No, turn it down. That's the appropriate...
Well, I'm glad you called, Becky, and I can't wait to see you in person and give you a nice big hug. We can kind of squeeze breast to breast.
Ah, well.
And I will be happy to contribute to that particular hug.
Talk soon, Becky.
Hey, you can be the gadfly next year, Anita.
Hey, I tell you, I had to look it up in the dictionary and ask my friends.
All right, you two. Thank you for calling, Becky. I'm going to play now a little bit, as I was saying before, about Michael Nudo, and I kind of interrupted. I didn't really respond. I responded to what you said about your saying, what's wrong with under God? You know, I'd like people to be able to say that. Let me allow a much more eloquent person to give you his point of view. Michael Nudo, speaking before the Monterey Peninsula College of the Law, and then at 11:30, we're going to give a call to Paul Sanford, who was there when Michael Nudo argued this case before the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago. And a decision is expected this summer.
I think that there are no... I think, first of all, the idea of ceremonial anything with regard to religion is an establishment. I mean, if it's become so ingrained in our society...
Let me clarify where we are. One of the questioners who is imitating a Supreme Court justice or representing a Supreme Court justice said, well, isn't this just the ceremonial words, the words under God, like on the money, under God? I mean, you want to eliminate under God from the money? I mean, come on. It's become a kind of a neutral, sort of a nice, thing, which is not particularly symbolic of any particular religious belief. It doesn't wed you to any religious belief. It's just ceremonial, and this is Newdow's response to that.
Just ceremonial, we have established it, and there, by definition, as far as I'm concerned, it violates the Establishment Clause. I also, every time I hear somebody mention ceremonial deism, I picture some 20-year-old black male driving down the street and being pulled over for driving while black, and having the officer come up to him and say, "Officer, I didn't do anything. Why are you pulling me over?" "Well, because you're black." So, well, that's racism. No, this is ceremonial racism. I mean, what sort of argument is this? What is this? If you are saying that you have this idea that there's this belief in God and it's so ceremonial, to me that is a violation of the Establishment Clause, and to put a fancy adjective in front of it doesn't seem to change that.
The question is whether the flesh, the two words, actually establishes religion. And you're kind of presupposing the argument that the Establishment Clause and all religion, but isn't the argument of the government that it's there but it doesn't really establish religion?
No, it doesn't say, the Establishment Clause doesn't say it has to establish religion. The Establishment Clause, when one looks through the history and the sequence of its development, they tried. They had a national religion. That was James Madison's view. They had established religions. They had all sorts of phrases, and they came out with the most broad language I can imagine. A law respecting an establishment of religion. That means no law with anything to do with establishing religion. We are clearly trying to tell people that we are a nation under God. Congress said we are doing this to inculcate the idea that we are going to acknowledge and be dedicated to the Almighty. I don't see how that could not fall within these confines of a law respecting an establishment of religion.
What do you think the outcome will be if this court agrees with you and holds the president unconstitutional? Don't you think that very quickly the Constitution will be amended?
I
allow that, and you'll be in a worse position than you are now?
That certainly is possible. I hope the American public is smart enough to recognize that. If you can do this today with God, you can do it tomorrow with Jesus, you can do it the next day with Protestantism, and get back to exactly where we were when this country was founded. And we realized those things, and that's why we made a federal constitution that kept that out. And I can only hope that the American people will understand this case and recognize this isn't an assault on their God. They have every right to go out into the public square and worship Jesus or whomever they wish at any time as much as they want. They just don't have the right to use government to do that. And that's what they've tried to accomplish here with Under God and the Pledge of Allegiance. I'd like to make one comment on a brief story, if I might, on when I first became involved in this case. Before it had broken, nobody knew about it. And I sat down at a cafeteria with a colleague of mine, a physician, and a nephrologist, so he's got one of the more cerebral subspecialties. And he was from Russia, and he was Jewish. Now, I think if anybody would understand the idea of repression by the basis of by the state in terms of religion, it would be a Russian Jew. And we had this discussion, and I said, you know, I'm trying to get under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance. He said, oh, what's with that? And I said, well, you know, I don't believe in God, and this is offensive to me. I send my kid to school every day, and she has to say that we're a nation under God. He said, no, I don't understand that. I said, well, you're Jewish, right? What would you think if this were one nation under Jesus? Would that bother you? He said, oh, yeah. I said, well, don't you see that to me, under God is exactly the same as under Jesus to you? He says, yeah, but this is God. And we went through this like four times. And he just couldn't see that to me, it's exactly the same thing. I hope this court can understand. You have to put yourself in my shoes. That's the job of the court, to recognize that there are people with minority religious views in this state, in this country, and that we have to be represented and we have to be protected, and we're not. And as a result of that lack of protection, atheists suffer significant harms in this country. We cannot get elected to public office. The polls show consistently that half of the population would refuse to vote for an atheist. That's compared to like 6% for a Jew, 4% for a Baptist, 4% for a Catholic. Half the population wouldn't vote for an atheist. 32% of the population holds negative views about atheists just on the basis of their atheism. And I can have, there's a, one of the amicus briefs, I hope, will be detailing the injuries to atheists throughout this country. It's been going on since the founding of our nation, and it's time to stop it. Just like blacks were second-class citizens until this court stood tall and said, we're not allowing segregation anymore, and just as the outcry was great and people might have considered having a constitutional amendment so that we can have segregation, we said no. And now we don't see this animosity towards integration. In fact, we think that our country is richer as a result. And I think the exact same thing will happen here. Eventually, we'll recognize that atheists are people just like everybody else. We have religious views that we hold dear to just like everybody else. And we have the right to be part of this society, which we are not right now, as this court has continually as our government has continually allowed deistic and theistic impositions into its laws. And I think especially this is necessary in the public schools, where again, this court in 9 out of 9 cases has upheld the idea that the Establishment Clause must be strictly adhered to. When we're talking about little children in schools, in a compulsive atmosphere, you cannot start indoctrinating religious beliefs, and we do that every day with our Pledge of Allegiance. I would like to also mention Zorak v. Clausen, which is constantly referred to by the petitioners, this idea that we are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being, and everybody says that, oh, Justice Douglas said that, and it's clear that we are religious people and there's a supreme being. Justice Douglas saw what had been happening with that phrase, and he came back in McGowan in 1961 and said, I realize what's happening. He said, yes, I said that we are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being. But if a religious leaven is to be worked into the affairs of our people, it's to be done by individuals and groups, not by government. And this court has repeatedly stated that in the terms of its neutrality analyses, which every one of the justices who've written on this topic has said, government must remain neutral. There is no neutrality when you say that we are a nation under God. We are not a nation under God. We are a nation that has people with different religious views, and we are supposed to respect that diversity. And it's very easy, it seems to me, and that's why we have an establishment clause, for individuals to forget that. President Bush, last year in the National Day of Prayer, said America welcomes individuals of all backgrounds and religions, and our citizens hold diverse beliefs. Pretty nice idea, pretty nice acknowledgement of the diversity of our country. And in his next sentence, he said, in prayer, we share the universal desire to speak and listen to our Maker. Thank you, Mr. President. I think that this happens repeatedly. People forget that we are a minority in this country, atheists, and we need to be protected, and especially children. Children should not be told every day that atheists are second-class citizens, as I believe they are informed each time the Pledge of Allegiance is repeated.
We take as an example President Bush's speech. That speech was broadcast in Fox News and the
President's It's very difficult with the President. The President also has his free exercise rights. I would say that as speaking as a governmental official, he shouldn't do that. It's a much different situation. Here we have Congress that created a law that is in the United States Code that says we are a nation under God.
But that speech played to school children for every day for a week.
I would argue. I would argue that by saying again, think of it in terms of Jesus. If he said every day for a week that we are a nation under Jesus, would that be an endorsement? I would say yes, and I think he shouldn't do that. I don't know. We have separation of powers issues coming into play then, but I think that that's clearly unconstitutional by the establishment clause.
But these children, is that a coercive environment?
Certainly. They're stuck and they can't leave. They're required by law to attend school.
But they're not required by law to attend.
But this court has repeatedly stated that you don't have to have the active participation. Being there and having your, especially impressionable school children are not the types of individuals who are going to stand up and say, yeah, I'm going to be an atheist. They're going to conform to all their fellow students say, especially when led by their teacher, who they have this utmost respect for.
How is it that you did not end up conforming to whatever religion you have?
Some of us are extraordinarily strong. I don't know.
Strong or stubborn? Thank you to everyone, first to the audience for your attention, and in advance for your willingness to fill out the questionnaires.
And that was Paul Sanford, and the speaker, of course, was Michael Newdow. The last voice was that of Paul Sanford, who's the local attorney who's taken cases both high and mighty and low and, I don't want to say feeble, but he's represented people from all kinds of groups. He's recently represented John Maurer, the man who had the Fuck the Pigs sign in his hat after police had harassed him and ticketed him 4 times. He simply put the sign in protest what the police had done, and he was ticketed for it. Actually, one of those 4 tickets was for that sign. And when Sanford took his case, the city attorney beat a shamefaced retreat, and I don't think there have been any further tickets given, although the law, which had to do with panhandling with profane language, similar to Kennedy's decorum law at city council, did not get to go before the court to be dumped completely, as it should have been. And this is what the city attorney does. Anyway, Sanford is going to be coming on the air shortly. And before we do that, Anita, do you have any comments you want to make?
Well, I find that a little disturbing, Robert. You know, we disagree on some things, but, you know, we have to have a belief in something higher and bigger than ourself. And I, as a Jew, would be offended if it was, you know, one nation under Jesus. But I don't think that's a very good analogy. I think that God is a very broad thing. I feel comforted by knowing that I live in a nation that's under God or under a higher power, be it Jew or Gentile or Muslim. There has to be something bigger. And what would he rather we say, you know, under Mother Earth or under Father Sky? I mean, what are we going to attribute this miracle of life, you know, that we have to? I just think it's very self-centered. I don't think it's doing any harm to children at all. I think more harm is done by letting children think there is an Easter Bunny or Santa Claus or a Tooth Fairy. But no, I would hate to see that come out, Robert. I have very fond memories of reciting it as a child, being proud, seeing my children recite it. And I hope they don't stop reciting it, and I wonder what the viewers think about that. Or not the viewers, but the listeners. Maybe they have opinions they can call in.
Yeah, well, of course, the Pledge of Allegiance doesn't have anything to do with God. It has to do with pledging allegiance to the flag
well,
and the Republic.
Well, it's patriotic. You know, it's just patriotic.
And the Republic.
And it makes you feel empowered and strengthened. I enjoyed it as a child.
Well, I understand. And many people who believe in God would. But, I mean, it's many people who believe in Catholicism would feel even more empowered if you said under the Pope. But, I mean,
we say one nation indivisible, but we have states breaking away with Prop 215 laws. We have states breaking away with gay marriage. I mean, so are we a nation indivisible?
Well,
I mean, are we free thinkers? I mean, you know.
But the religion is such a charged issue, you know, and such a personal issue. And the issue.
Well, we have freedom of religion, but I don't know about freedom
of
no
children,
religion.
Not for school children. Oh, yeah, you should have freedom. Freedom from religion. You can't have freedom
well,
of religion.
Well, you can
religion
have freedom
from
religion, but to have no religion, I just, to me, it's just a little deviant.
People should have a right to have no religion. No?
Well, people have a right to do what they like, you know,
yeah.
Free choice. That's why we live in America.
We have a caller. Let's see what that caller says. Hi, you're on Free Radio. I hope you're... Are you under God or not?
I hope not. Hmm? I'm
Uh-oh.
Above God.
Now, wait a minute. Are you some sort of a atheistic dog? What's going on here?
I think the word would be agnostic.
Okay. Well,
I believe... I'm okay with the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm very anti-religious. I can't... I think religion is a form of mental illness, but I think... it's okay for me to hear the word under God. First of all, most people I know who went through school and pledged allegiance did not grow up to be religious people. I really do believe that there's something, we're predestined to be religious or not religious. I really think that. I think there's nothing anybody can do to me that's ever going to make me religious. And when I hear the word under God, I just think, I agree with your co-host there that...
Well, I liked what you said about being an agnostic. I can see saying as an adult... thinking person, you know what, I just don't know.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
To be an atheist and say there is nothing
that's just crazy.
To me, it just doesn't make sense.
No, how can you deny that there's got to be something out there who made us. I mean, I'm walking on grass in my backyard right now. I didn't make
right.
that grass. You
and
know,
yet
I
there
didn't.
Are some crazy people who just are atheists. Can you imagine that?
We can imagine and we can accept them. It doesn't
right.
mean
and
that...
You're going to make their kids say under God or
I'm not going to make their kids do diddly
well,
squat.
The compulsive atmosphere of the classroom puts them in a position where if they aren't saying it, they're noticed by the other children and it becomes a position...
Well, their parents need to build their self-esteem, though. I enjoyed watching my children
say... Why not say under the Pope? Why not say under...
Because I'm a Jew.
Well, right.
It shouldn't
exactly.
be anything specific. It should be
but
to a higher power, to Mother
well,
Earth, to Father Sky. Who
well,
gives
it would be kind of awkward to hear it say, you know, one nation under Buddha or one
there
nation,
you don't,
nation
you don't
under
need
Allah.
Any under anything.
Yeah, you could just write one nation under all.
We had the Pledge of Allegiance. Caller, we had the Pledge of Allegiance before and without under anything. This
yeah,
for many
right.
years, it was a fine pledge until the Congress decided they were going to show how religious they were. In an unconstitutional fashion.
Well, it might be more appropriate in today's society to say one nation under McDonald's or under Halliburton.
There we go.
One nation under corporate rule.
Under Bush. There
I'll
we go.
Get that. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Okay, thanks
for calling.
So hopefully we can get a call from Paul. I'm going to try again to reach him on the phone. He's a busy guy, and this is a Sunday, so that may be the reason we're...
And we've also got the daylight savings.
And there is a daylight savings confusion. Yeah, that may be the reason.
You knew about that. But we're still asking other callers to call in and talk about
the
issue of the pledge.
Sure, 427-3772, number to call.
Yeah, call in and talk about anything you might want to talk about. It's a beautiful Sunday morning in our beautiful Santa Cruz County.
I think I'm going to try another number. Maybe we'll get some action here.
Okay, while you're doing that, I wanted to mention something about Dr. Denny. A caller earlier mentioned... He had some documentation from Dr. Denny, but it wasn't current or he didn't have it updated. I recently got an email that Dr. Denny has just recently opened an office down in... where did he open it? He opened an office in Southern California. For those of you who did get your documentation from Philip Denny, I have a little printout that I printed from my laptop. He is a doctor who approved cannabis use by some 8,000 Northern California patients and has now opened a practice in Orange County. He is joined in that practice by Robert Sullivan, a former associate. Their offices are located on Lambert Street in Lake Forest. If you are in need of a physician's referral or want more information about your rights under Prop 215 or physician's rights and responsibilities under 215, and you have access to a computer or you have access to get to the public library and get online, you can find a doctor in Central or Northern California and even Southern California by logging on to www.canorml.org/prop/215physicians. And that is the California Normal website. And they have a pretty extensive listing of physicians who will see you and are sensitive to the subject and will more than likely write a recommendation for you if you are in need. It also says here that since 1996, 75,000 patients are thought to have obtained physicians' referrals. Now, if that's your family doctor or your regular doctor, I think that's fabulous. What irritates me are people who are going to doctors and paying $200, $300, $350 to get a doctor's letter or some kind of a recommendation. It's a ripoff. And people who are in need of cannabis are ill to begin with. They don't need to have it socked to them in their pocketbook. So hopefully not too many of those 75,000 had to go out of their way to pay doctors extraordinary amounts of money to get something they are entitled to. And what else can I say? Yeah, that's just about it. What do you got to say, Robert? Anything about this? Or no, should we change the subject? I can look at these safe
access. Actually, I think we may be getting a bite on the line from that old atheist dog, or should I say advocate for the atheist organization.
No, sorry, old atheist dog.
Paul Sanford.
Good. Why, you think he's going to call?
Well, I'm harassing him at home even as we speak.
He's avoiding your call.
Yeah.
He knows I'm on.
Okay, so we have him. Paul will be on the line in 20 seconds.
Oh, he's calling in. Okay.
He's actually being called by us, but that's good. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, in case you'd forgotten. 427-3772 is the number to call after this caller.
Remind us again who the caller is, Robert.
That will be an attorney, our local Paul Sanford, who is arguing before the Supreme Court a support for amicus brief.
Mr. Norris?
Yes, actually, we've got you online here. I'm introducing you even as we speak.
You know what? I'm going to either call you or have you call me on my cell phone since I'm going to be traveling. And I apologize for the technical difficulties. I'm working
call,
on it.
Call us right back.
427-3772. Got
it. Okay. All righty.
Boy, technology, I tell you.
Yay, that's those little cellular phones. We have another caller. Caller, you have 30 seconds.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Robert.
We'll give you a little more time since it's you.
Hey. I'm sorry. It's a confusing morning because I've been talking with major entertainment companies about the motion picture to follow with regard to Mr. Newdow.
Under God, the movie?
Yeah. I'm less interested in the title than actually securing the rights and getting it produced. And I was actually just talking to the screenplay writer about
it. Well, I will be, of course, having a starring role, right?
Well, I think you're pegged in as Chief Justice Rehnquist.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
You will
be honorable.
Have to shave, which is a burden.
He's looking like Moses right now.
I'm trying to, actually, we have in the studio with us, Paul, Anita Henry, who is a should we say, got a different position. She believes that under God should be kept in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh, terrific. That's what makes this country great, the fact that people have different positions.
And I know that that you argued exactly the opposite position on behalf of, the American Atheists Association?
I argued for the American Atheists and filed a brief for them. By the way, what are your call letters? You don't say those often enough, Robert, and I know people who want to be tuning in that
sure.
can't.
Well, it's actually a big secret. We're not going to tell you.
Okay.
It's 96.3 FM and 101.
If I tell you, honey, I have to shoot you.
That's one of the problems.
96.3 FM.
We are on, orange alert. Maybe even reduced to yellow alert. 101.1 FM, 96.
Or 101.1.
And it's also, in case if you're outside the area, you can also try us on the internet at www.freakradio.org.
And
well,
then
you know
how about that 96.3?
Yeah, we didn't say that. I did say that.
I would love to hear a little bit more, because I'm talking all the time about your guest's viewpoint and what her concerns are about restoring the pledge to its original form that served this country beautifully for over 60 years.
Well, Anita is actually we've been working on the issue of medical marijuana. Huff is planning, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom is planning a medical marijuana giveaway in front of City Hall for poor people, and that's been the main subject. But Anita has many opinions on many subjects, and she's very articulate. Go ahead, Anita, take it away.
Take it away. Let me see. Yeah, I'm happy with the Pledge of Allegiance the way it is, and as I was just telling Robert, we were listening to a bit of a tape. I think atheists have a right to be atheists, although I don't understand why they're not agnostic. I mean, don't laugh at me, Robert. You know, I was raised a Jew. I'm not a practicing religious person. I do believe in a higher power. I don't think that man is the ultimate. I mean, even when I was younger, I used to question and say, how can psychiatrists study the human mind when they are of the human mind?
Well, I have a question, though. In your mindset, is there any room for a belief system that's different from yours, that you believe there's a higher power? Can you respect the idea that there are some people, honest, smart, conscientious people, who believe there is not? Is that, you know, within your reasoning?
Well, I'm not an intolerant person, and I believe I'm a flexible person and a free-thinking person. But it's a difficult concept for me to grasp.
There are people who think that organized religion and this, the monotheistic one-God approach, which generally includes some form of afterlife, has caused incredible harm, and I'm not saying this is my view, but harm and destruction through the history of humanity, and the religious wars, and this promise that, oh, don't worry, you know, you're a 15th century peasant and your teeth hurt all the time and you don't have any food, but don't worry, you're going to get your reward after you die, that this is an approach that has oppressed people, and that man invented this higher power concept to keep people subservient. I'm not saying I believe that, but can you see why some people think the role of God in the history of humanity has been destructive and believe that we shouldn't rely on the concepts of gods or fairies or witches, and that we should instead rely on the forces of nature and science?
I do, but I also believe that the forces of nature are ruled by some kind of energy or power that's bigger.
Well, I understand what you believe, and I respect that. I'm just saying, can you understand that reasonable, rational people don't believe in God and believe there is not a God?
I can accept that people do believe that way.
But it's not a valid belief?
I'm having a difficult time with it, to be quite honest with you, as a mother, as a grandmother, as somebody who just enjoys everything about nature, who just the beauty of eating food and having a good bowel movement, the mechanisms of how a body works. This was no accident.
That's your opinion that it was no accident. No one knows the answer to that question.
Why not be an agnostic and say, you know what,
well,
we just don't know.
Atheists aren't agnostics. Well, that's like saying for me to say to you, why not be an atheist? I mean, it's really not fair for one person to challenge someone else's belief system and say, why don't you believe something else because I disagree with you? You know, but the Pledge of Allegiance question isn't about what people believe. It's wonderful that people celebrate their God or their gods. The question is whether or not the federal government should be mandating 5- and 6-year-olds to pledge allegiance to a particular religious approach, which is monotheism, before they even know what it is. You know, this is an issue of church and state. It's not an issue of what people believe in. It's whether the government, the First Amendment bans the government from being involved in this equation at all. It says no, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. It's illegal and unconstitutional for the government to be involved.
And isn't that why they ended prayer in school? Now sitting and saying,
yeah, that's right.
Well, saying a prayer in school,
they did.
But isn't saying a prayer in school a little bit different than saying something that's patriotic?
It's not no different whatsoever. The Pledge of Allegiance for 60 years had no reference to God in it. In 1954, during the height of McCarthyism, the Congress inserted the words under God for specific religious purposes to send a message to those godless communists. That action was specifically respecting the establishment of religion and blatantly unconstitutional. Well, the pledge was a patriotic exercise for over 60 years, and they turned it into one nation, indivisible, oops, we mean divided by religion. And it's unconscionable what the Congress did. You know, whether people believe in God is wonderful, and whether people want to add the words, if you're saying the pledge, no one, you know, you should be allowed to say under God, but you shouldn't be required to.
I agree with you. I don't think anybody should be required to do anything they don't want, but from my own personal opinion, I find it comforting to know that the majority of Americans do believe in some sort of God or higher power and don't have a problem reciting and reinforcing how they feel about their country.
Now, that's a valid, that's a very extremely good point, and I'm glad you feel that way, and it gives you some comfort, and it's a very rational view. The question is whether judges, who are supposed to be independent, whose job is just to apply the Constitution, can separate what the public likes from what from paths and places where the government is not allowed to be.
Well, I love to say God bless America, and I would hate to see that disappear from the vernacular or my vocabulary.
No, we just don't require every morning before school starts to take 6- and 7-year-olds, force them to put their hands on their heart, look at the flag, and sing it under orders of their teacher. That's what we're trying to avoid.
You make it sound like it's a very oppressive kind of gesture, but I have watched my grandson say the pledge in school, and I'm just filled with pride.
Well, if they took out the words under God, you'd be less proud?
I don't think I would be less proud, but...
Okay, then let's get rid of them. They're divisive. They're alienating, you know, a big segment of our population for no reason. The government... Robert, do you have the Constitution with you, or do I need to drag mine out?
Well, how big a population are you talking about? Because I'm really very...
It doesn't matter. It does not matter. This is a country where free thought and freedom of religion is pervasive. It turns out the atheists are certainly a lot more than 10% of our country, but it wouldn't matter if they're 1/100 of 1%. They're Americans as patriotic as any others, and as skeptical probably as any others.
Are their values similar? Are their values?
Doesn't make any difference. That's the freedom of conscience. This is why we fought. Why we threw off the tyranny of the English is that we want freedom of conscience, freedom to criticize our government, and freedom to believe whatever we want to believe, whether others agree or not.
Paul,
the atheist is irrelevant.
You asked me what I don't have a copy of the Constitution, but I know the First Amendment by heart.
Okay.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Okay, that's good right there.
And then the rest of it's freedom of press, speech, and assembly.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's wonderful, but it doesn't... We don't live in a democracy. We live in a republic.
Well, we live in a Christian society, and I know that. Jew, I've noticed my entire life that this is just a Christian
society.
And
how would you feel if it said one nation under Christ? Would you be proud?
I would be very uncomfortable. I also would be uncomfortable.
Don't you think the atheists are as uncomfortable as you are?
But I wouldn't want it to say one. I wouldn't want it to say one nation under Moses or under Abraham or under
Buddha. But God is fine because it only is excluding 15% of the population, and it doesn't exclude the Jews.
Well,
does that make it okay? Atheists have strong fundamental religious viewpoints and values. They believe there's no God, and they're excluded. But one nation under Jesus would be no good because that excludes people who are Jewish. But one nation under God is okay because it only excludes the atheists. I mean, you must see the contradiction in this argument.
So, Paul, you've made your point, and
I think God is a very generic. Very generic.
What about goddess? Let's talk about God. What about one nation under goddess?
It does not include people who believe there's no God, and you can't make an argument that suggests there is. And that viewpoint is every bit as valid as anyone else's.
Paul, you argued this before the Supreme Court. How long did you actually spend talking to the
Well, I didn't directly argue with the court. Dr. Newnau, there's only 30 minutes for the argument. I was with him, and I helped him prepare and so forth. I filed a brief on behalf of the American Atheists. I don't happen to be a member of the American Atheists, but I'm very proud to be associated with them and to defend their rights.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not speak directly with the justices on the case.
Were you within spitting distance of Rehnquist?
Pretty darn close,
yeah. Did you spit?
I didn't even consider decorum. I was pleased enough to somehow get sworn into that high court. I decided not to get banned on my first day.
Were you searched before you came in?
No, it's the same as going into any courtroom. It's not much different than the Santa Cruz courtroom.
You want to describe for us is this your first time before the Supreme Court, or
yeah.
You've been there before?
No, it's the first time.
So what was your experience watching these Nine Clowns, listen to a man who wants to remove the words. I don't have a lot of respect for the Supreme Court, but you know, as you can hear. But what was your experience there? What tell us what happened? How it went?
Well, you know, first of all, there were only 8 justices present because although you know the Sierra Club has been unable to get Justice Scalia to recuse himself from the case involving his hunting buddy Dick Cheney, Dr. Newdow did succeed and got Scalia to recuse himself from this case. There were only 8 justices, and what was fascinating is they sit in these huge chairs. It reminded me, I don't know if you know, remember the old Lily Tomlin skit when she's Edith Ann, this, you know, sitting, this little girl sitting in this gigantic chair.
And that's the truth.
That's what they look like, and it actually helped. Dr. Newdow mentioned that analogy, and it helped him quite a bit, remembering that these are just people, and he had a conversation with them, and they did look small in their big chairs, and I have to say, it was more like a dinner table conversation than a Supreme Court argument, and Dr. Newdow carried the day because he had the wherewithal to pull it off. I mean, it was really just something incredible.
So do you, this was recorded, I guess, but it wasn't broadcast, right?
That's correct. I don't know if they even record. They broadcast it into one room inside the building for lawyers who weren't able to fit into, who were sworn into the bar, weren't able to fit into the chamber. I don't even know if they retain those tapes. There are no cameras allowed whatsoever. It's an old world body. There is a transcript.
What do you think the next step is going to be, and what do you think the outcome will be?
Well, the next step is just to wait to see what the court does. The ruling will probably come sometime in June. My guess is that Dr. Newdow will lose, even though the vast majority of observers who are constitutional scholars agree that he is correct on the law. The question is whether this highly political court, and it's not just this one, all of the Supreme Courts are highly political, whether they will have the courage to apply the law faithfully or whether they will choose the expedient political solution. I do think for sure if it's the other 41 states. If he only gets 3 votes, then he goes down. If he gets 5 votes, then the words are eliminated altogether.
So, you want to tell us more about how the argument went? I know I heard Newdow arguing before the mock Supreme Court in Monterey, and I played that tape, bad as it is, in terms of quality, for listeners here on Free Radio. By the way, you're listening to Paul Sanford, who went with Michael Newdow to the U.S. Supreme Court a couple weeks ago to argue that the words "under God" should be struck from the Pledge of Allegiance, which school children are pressured or actually directed to say every morning across the country.
Not forced, encouraged, but not forced.
Well, when you're instructed to do so, and why don't you respond to that, Paul? They're not forced to do it.
There's a law out there. There's a case law that says that Jehovah's Witnesses brought in the 40s that say technically no one can be required to pledge allegiance. But the whole point of elementary school, kindergarten, first grade, especially, is socialization, is learning how to do what your teacher tells you. The teachers generally, I'm certain, don't instruct the students that you don't have to do this. And besides, even if the students knew, let's say they're fourth graders and someone told them they don't have to do it, it's incredibly coercive. You're going to be, who can expect a child 6, 7, 8, 9 years old to be able to have the wherewithal to understand these issues? Instead, they get pushed and forced into doing something that they don't even understand. And if they do leave the room, or if they do just stay in their seat, they're going to be branded unpatriotic, and they're going to become outsiders. And why is that happening? Because the government is inserting itself into an equation where it constitutionally is not allowed to be.
Well, these children are going to have to grow up and live in the larger world, so...
Right, the word world, larger world, where atheists are oppressed and where Jews are oppressed, in part by governments.
Well, I think that perhaps we should segregate the classrooms in order to get people more accustomed to the segregation that they're going to be facing later in life.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely true. Anyway, the issue is obviously a really important one because people feel strongly about it. There were people feeling strongly outside the court. You had mass protests going on at the same time, right?
Yeah, there were protests, and not only here, there were protests in New York and San Francisco.
For or against? What were they protesting?
Well, they're both. Strong contingents on both. There were more persons from the Christian right than there were from the respect the First Amendment sides, I would say.
Any Islamic protesters who want to see the under God mentioned in the...
Yeah, I saw some signs that had reference to that. I don't remember, and you know, as you know, it's impossible to determine one's faith by their outward appearance.
Any comments by Supreme Court justices that you thought were particularly noteworthy?
Well, I thought the most interesting repartee of the day was when Chief Justice Rehnquist tried to set a trap for Dr. Newdow, and he basically said, well, what was the vote in Congress when they put this provision in, added the words under God? And Newdow said, I think it was unanimous. And Rehnquist said, doesn't sound very divisive to me, and thinking he'd sort of still on the show. And Newdow, without pausing, said, no, Mr. Chief Justice, it just shows that atheists cannot be elected to public office in America. And the courtroom burst into applause, in something that there's no record ever of applause in the Supreme Court in its long history. It's a dramatic moment that showed Newdow's depth and ability to respond. And people forget, and I know that your guest is, I'm certain, a brilliant and warm-hearted person, but a lot of people don't have the ability to understand that atheists have rights, too. We would never say to a Jewish person, well, why don't you just believe something else? Why don't you just go be agnostic? And but the idea that we would say that to an atheist is shocking to me, and that people don't seem to be able to break through the wall and understand that atheists have rights, too, and atheists are injured when they're forced to make a choice between being excluded from school or society or being hypocrites.
How did the news media cover this? Do you feel that you got fair treatment? I saw the New York Times coverage. It was kind of extensive, and I was actually going to try to call you on that. I think you were still out of town, or maybe I wasn't able to reach you. How do you feel this went out? I mean, I got a lot of press. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the reviews have been extraordinary. The New York Times described Dr. Newdow as spellbinding. The Washington Post characterized it as justices in search of a rationale to stop Newdow. What's the most intriguing constitutional question is when he loses, which he probably will. I think he's increased his chances of succeeding maybe from 1% to 15% by his remarkable performance. But most likely he loses, and what we're all curious about is where are they going to hang their hat? What's the rationale going to be to allow this? Because this is not a close call. This is a government blatantly inserting itself into religious discussion and acting in direct support of monotheism. It's direct support of the belief that there is one God. And so that's what I'm anxious to see. The news media handled it beautifully. I have to apologize because I've got to run. I have a client that's been patiently waiting for me, Dr. Norris.
All right. Well, listen.
I do hope that your doctorate came in the mail.
The document has not necessarily come in the mail, but the mail doesn't come on Sunday, so we'll have to see what happens tomorrow.
Well, I'll call you Dr. Norris starting when it arrives.
Yes, indeed. And to try to show some more respect when you do that. Your Majesty would be better, actually.
All right, Justice.
Okay, good to speak
to you. Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
Thank you,
bye,
Paul Sanford.
Bye.
That was Paul Sanford, attorney for the American Atheists, supporting Michael Newdow, who's actually both a medical doctor and an attorney, arguing his own case before the Supreme Court on eliminating the words under God from the Pledge of Allegiance as a mandatory, or shall I say, mandatory isn't quite the word, but heavily encouraged, well, it is required, and it's required you say the pledge. I guess it's not necessarily, I guess it's not required you say the pledge. You could stand aside, but I wonder how many children really feel that they can do that. There's probably a lot of pressure to do it. Anyway, we've been talking about that. On the air with me is Anita Henry. Two new guests have entered the studio. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. We have the infamous Don Alden, a.k.a. Dirt Clod, the man whose vehicle has disappeared into the impound lot and has been left sitting on the street. And then we have the controversial Paul Marcel and Sampson, whose questionable attacks on Safeway have led to us calling the Labor Stalinist Central Committee to have him thugged out. We'll have the thugs here ready to take care of you in a few minutes, Paul. Actually, there is a real discussion on the nature of the Safeway controversy, which I was trying to organize for today. I don't know if it's going to happen. I haven't heard from Louis LaFortune. Maybe my producer, if she's listening, can give a call to old Louis and see if he's off the loo, so to speak, or maybe he's, you know, going an hour earlier, because everybody thinks it's actually 11. It isn't. It's 12. We're moving right along here. And again, you're tuned to 96.3, 101.1, and or www.freakradio.org in Santa Cruz. I think what I'm going to do now is ask... I'm getting some strange signals from my
well,
host.
Well, I was wondering if anybody else wanted to call in and talk about the medical marijuana issue.
Oh, yeah.
The
cannabis distribution we are planning at City Hall or anything else besides that before I take my fine self out of the
She's
studio.
She's about to leave us.
And just, out onto the
It's gotten
the
too
street.
Male here for her. I see that. We have an incoming call. Perhaps this could be the, you know, maybe the Chief Scary is calling in. Hi there. You're on Free Radio with Anita, Robert, Don, and the infamous Paul.
I just want to say free pot, abolish the pledge, and single-payer health care for all.
Hey, thank you.
Those are my positions.
All right.
This is Louis. When did you become a doctor, Robert?
I have been keeping close watch on certain individuals for a long time and in most intimate of circumstances. I don't want to go into that at the present time. It might be a little too progressive for this audience.
Oh, did you succumb to one of those buy yourself a doctorate things online?
I give myself a buy on the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, Louis, you're calling in. Actually, this is an opportune moment for me to oust Anita from the mic and move Paul, Marcel, and Samson into the driver's seat.
Yeah, well, I just want to compliment you, Robert, on that just wonderful show so far. You and Anita, whom I don't know.
And you will know more of her. You will see her more, possibly behind prison bars. Hopefully not, actually. Anita says no, but anyone who has got the courage to stand up with free medical marijuana... and particularly against the ire of the local marijuana establishment, we're talking about the corrals, the city council, the board of supervisors, deserves, well, she's not going to get what she deserves, but I, for at least from some of us, I hope she gets what she deserves.
Yeah, so this is going to be a pot giveaway?
That's the plan. Part of it is, of course, to get marijuana out to people. The other part of it is to pressure the city council to change its no cannabis clubs zoning prohibitions, which they passed in 2000, which they continue, as well as the corrals, to remain silent on.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, we need to get a distribution center in the city of Santa Cruz where people can access cannabis without going to the surrounding counties and without waiting on a long list to get into WAM. And I have a very small service. I'm not able to provide service to the many, many hundreds of people in Santa Cruz. And we want the city council to take notice, the board of supervisors to take notice, and anybody else who is interested in the issue to take notice. We are working on this. We will be needing some help. I'm sure Robert will be telling you more about it. But as of right now, we are planning a free distribution of cannabis at the city hall. We don't know exactly when. You will need to be documented. Either bring a note from your doctor or one of the cards from one of the centers, either in Oakland or Haywood or Berkeley. And we'll see how it goes from there. And I'll leave it in Robert's hands until we speak again.
And for those who, again, have any information, Louis, I should ask you, where do you get your marijuana from, and is it accessible? Are you concerned that there are no clubs available? Are you able to get marijuana from an apt supply?
You're talking to me?
I'm talking to you,
anybody.
Buddy.
Yeah, you're talking to me? Talking to you.
On the air.
I do not get marijuana.
You don't?
Not a user.
No. I see. Okay, well, I will try to forgive you, you old fuddy-duddy. I'm not much of a user.
Actually, once in a while, you know, if there's a joint being passed around, I will partake. But
yeah,
no,
there
I'm
you
not.
Go. So you're a casual user.
I'm not a regular user, no.
Good. Well, many people aren't regular users. And I don't think many people should be regular users because it really is a drug. And I think that's the one point that if I make any point to young people today is every time you're smoking a joint, you are medicating yourself. You're not just like getting high. Cannabis is a drug.
But a much more beneficent drug than alcohol. So thank you, Anita, for being with us. And call Anita at 425-3444 if you want to discuss where you get your marijuana from. Not so much because we're looking to establish new sources, but because we're trying to establish whether people feel there's a need out there.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to turn to the Safeway issue.
Oh, I wanted to segue into
order in the studio,
the religion
everybody.
Thing, which, you know,
sorry?
As Mark said, religion is the opiate of the masses, and I thought we could make the drug connection there. That talk by Paul Sanford was just great. I was really impressed with him. He's got that kind of legal mind that sees issues very clearly, and I was really impressed with his remarks. I just wanted to fill you in a little, if I could take a minute, on the history of the pledge. It was created by a man named Francis Bellamy back in the 1890s. He was a socialist Baptist minister who was the cousin of the more famous Edward Bellamy, who wrote the utopian novel Looking Backward from the year 2000. And as a socialist, the Francis Bellamy used to deliver speeches from the pulpit on topics such as Jesus the Socialist. referring to Jesus's call for humanity to take care of one another, right, which is definitely a socialist sort of point of view. And he specifically left the words under God out, even though he was a minister, because he thought, as Paul Sanford said, that the First Amendment applied. And what I point out to people when we talk about the pledge is that this was his vision. This was Francis Bellamy's vision of what the United States could be. Imagine a country with freedom and justice for all, right? This was, you know, it's visionary. And so in that, this has changed my whole outlook on the pledge. You know, now I can say at least the last words and think, oh, this is good. You know, this is what we should have in this country. We certainly don't have freedom and justice for all.
Yeah.
Or equality under whatever.
Right. Interesting. I know I never read Looking Backward, but it was required reading. That's probably the reason I never did read.
Yeah, well, it's just surprising you became a doctor in spite of that.
Well, I get around. You know. In the studio with me is Paul Marcellin Sampson, and I'm struggling to get this debate online here as I talk to you, so I can read the arguments of the Safeway strikers, and who actually were kind of doing a sympathy strike or boycott with those in Southern California, and lost the strike recently in a rather grim kind of collapse, which kind of ended up not helping the workers a hell of a lot. And Paul Marcellin Sampson's here in the studio. Hi, Paul.
Hi there.
And Paul has kind of written. Have you gone online?
I did.
Louis,
I did.
Have you read Paul's stuff?
I did.
So for those who are interested in knowing, at the SantaCruzIndieMedia.org, there is a story, "We Will Shut Down the Safeway on Mission Street in Santa Cruz," from February 6th. You have to go back into the archives to get it. This is not so much a dead issue as it might be, since there's a new strike plan, and so this is still a live issue. Why don't you present, Louis, your thoughts about, first of all, what the strikers were struggling to get, and feel free also to make a few critical comments about, you know, how they could have improved their strike, but also just the general idea of their demands. And Paul, then you can present your sense of why those demands were unrealistic, or why they should be viewed in a different context, or whatever your thoughts are on that. Can you go ahead, Louis? We have a Louis LaFortune and Paul Marcellin Sampson talking about the Safeway strike. Go ahead, Paul. I mean, Louis, go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Robert. Yes, I'm not a union member, although, but I am very sympathetic with the, and impressed with the idea of unions, people organizing to improve the conditions of their lives. I mean, that's what unions are all about. The strike in Southern California inspired the Northern California Monterey Bay Central Labor Council and other organizations to arrange informational pickets and boycotts. There was no strike here, as you may know. By the way, the UFCW, which the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, which covers the Southern California workers, also covers the Northern California workers. In this part of the country, in our part of the state, their contract will expire in September. So we can expect that the same sort of struggle that went on down there will come to this neighborhood. By the way, the workers who were, when I was a store captain. I was at the Morrissey store. I was a co-captain with Sarah Ringler. And we were out there every Saturday for several weeks, for 3 or 4 hours, distributing flyers and encouraging people not to shop at Safeway and explaining to them what the issues were all about. And I must say we had some very good discussions with people about the concepts of health care, and what workers work for, you know, how they're compensated, what their costs are, what the realities of life are for the people inside who are stocking the shelves and checking out your groceries. Usually before each session, we would go into the store and talk to the workers. I didn't encounter anyone who was not happy that we were there. They were very supportive of our presence. They thanked us for being out there. They know that the same problems that they're having in Southern California are coming here, and they were pleased to see us out there. They could not join us because their contract does not permit them to do that. But when they were off duty, they would go to other stores and participate in the informational picket. So what are the issues? The issues were health care. It was basically not about wages at all. It was about losing their health care, not losing it. Up until that point, Safeway was paying the health care premiums for the workers, and they had little or no cost to the workers for their health care. When the contract expired, they were presented, this was last October in 2003, the workers in Southern California were presented a contract that called for large monthly payments, large monthly health care premiums, and in some cases, as much as a quarter of their wages. So it was completely an unbearable cost. You know, if you're paying a quarter or more of your income for rent and then clothing and food, to pay a quarter for your health care costs, it's just, it's not doable. So that was the reason. The management was proposing a two-tiered system where new hires would come in at a lower rate and in some cases would not be eligible for health care for 3 years, thus depriving them of that. It was just completely unacceptable to the workers, and you know, I agree with them. That definitely undermines their ability to negotiate. So that's why we were out there. Now, Paul, in his and I don't know you, Paul, but I'm looking forward to meeting you someday.
Same here.
Paul, in his article here on Santa Cruz Indie Media, says that the problem is Walmart. Well, the problem absolutely is Walmart and these other predatory stores that have even worse health care policies.
Louis, let me interrupt you for a moment, because maybe Paul should present his own perspective, and then you guys can go back and forth. It sounds like you're responding to his perspective, but he really hasn't had a chance to say it. Can you, if you summed up the issue, you think it's health care benefits?
Oh, definitely it is. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, is there more you want to say about that in your opening? Because you'll have a chance to raise other issues.
Sure. Okay.
So, Paul, you want to give your thoughts?
Okay. The first thing I would like to say is that when you post an article like that, people make all kinds of assumptions about who you are. And I very rarely shop at Safeway, and I am not a fan of Safeway by any means. I shop there when items are unaffordable at Food Bin or other local stores, which are very expensive, unfortunately. And I also shop there when I can't get, like, baking needs and, you know, basic kitchen supplies that aren't sold at places like Food Bin or New Leaf. So I'm not coming at this from a vested interest. I am an outsider to this, except as a consumer of food. I am concerned that there were some misrepresentations about the whole issue was characterized incorrectly. For an employer, we are looking at total compensation. The employer says it costs X dollars per hour on average to have an employee, and then ultimately it's up to the unions and the employer to negotiate how those X dollars will be spent. How much of the money is going to go to the senior people through a salary scale? In other words, how much less the junior employees will earn and how much more the senior ones will earn, and also to decide how much of the money will be spent on health care, how much of it will be spent on pensions and other things taken off the top. But for the employer, it's one big number. It's X dollars per hour on average for a particular type of employee. And if we look at things that way, then the group of employees is still doing fine economically if that X dollar per hour total amount keeps up with the cost of living. And the cost of living is the consumer price index, the best measure of it that we have, and it has been hovering between 2 and 3% locally in the Los Angeles region, and also here in this case in the Bay Area region, Marin County, San Francisco, Santa Clara County, San Mateo County. It's been hovering in the 2.2 to 2.5% range for several years, and is going to stay there until the economy picks up. And the CPI is a very broad measure. It includes health care. It includes cost of food, it includes the cost of housing, it includes the cost of energy. It is a weighted average also, so that, you know, we spend more of our income on rent. So a rent increase or a mortgage, an increase in mortgage rates is going to have a bigger effect on the CPI. So I want to move away from this idea of saying it was a dispute over health care. It's a dispute over that X dollars per hour and how it should be allocated. And basically, Safeway has provided generous increases if you look at the total compensation. And it is up to the unions, I think, to decide, or should have been up to them to decide on a fair allocation of the money. What they opted to do was to steal from the junior employees to maintain things for the senior folks. And I would have favored a middle-of-the-road solution that would have seen compensation rise for the junior employees and go down for the senior folks, bring everyone toward a more equal situation, because I believe in equal pay for work of equal value. The other issue for me is that there is a big risk. You mentioned Walmart. I looked at a report from the Bay Area Economic Forum, which happened to have been published right during the strike, a very reliable research report that looked at what happens when Walmarts come in to other big cities. And they can exert a tremendous pressure on supermarkets, cause them to close, undercut them on price, cause them to cut wages and benefits. That's not good. And that is coming to California. Walmart has a plan to build 40 stores in the Bay Area region, which in their view includes us here in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties as well. It's a broader view of the Bay Area. And then the other question is that Safeway was made out to be a hugely profitable, evil kind of enterprise. And in fact, Safeway had a net operating loss 2 years ago, had another net operating loss last year. And Safeway is also characterized by a very high reinvestment in its stores. I believe, I have to check my figures here, I mentioned it in the article, but I think it's two-thirds of gross profits are reinvested in store improvements. And Safeway is on a major campaign to renovate its stores and keep them viable in the future. That's unusual for other businesses. So I didn't buy this idea of making them out to be hugely profitable and evil. They believe in what they're doing, and they want to stay here. And this is their stronghold, and they want to keep it. They're not disinterested.
Let me get a response from you, Louis, on those three issues. Safeway, not so evil. That is to say, it reinvests and so forth, and is losing money. That's a consideration. Secondly, it's not all about health care. It's about the whole package, cost of living, and the issue of, you know, chopping from the juniors to keep the benefits for the seniors. And I guess the third point, I'm spacing out at this point, but why don't you address those?
On the not so profitable, we might look at executive compensation at Safeway. The CEO of Safeway is a man named Steve Bird. He pocketed $24 million in 2003. And yes, I totally agree with you, Paul. We should cut the salaries of the upper level workers and raise the salary of the people who are actually doing the work, you know, stocking the shelves, working the cash registers. $24 million? Okay, so, they may be profitable, and we can see where the profit is going. If they're not profitable, maybe that's the reason, you know, is that their upper executives are getting, to me, what is an obscene amount of money.
I agree with you there, but there's one Steve Bird in the company. I'm talking, the wage differential I was attacking is the fact that with the contract that the union approved, a junior person coming in the door will start, a food clerk, at $8.90 an hour, and his senior counterpart will end up at over $22 an hour under certain circumstances. That's where a lot of the money is going, in that differential.
Deviation
from the average.
Oh no, I agree. Yes, the workers should be paid a fair amount of money based on the amount of work they perform. And yes, it is certainly the tendency of companies to punish the low-level workers, young, who are looking for hungry, looking for jobs, at the expense of, to the benefit of people who have been there a long time. Well, of course, they're trying to retain these people, you know, so they won't go somewhere else for a basically what's a minimum wage job if they're only getting $7 or $8 an hour. But here, what we have here, it sounds to me, is like the we're pitting the workers against one another when actually we should be looking up. You know, this is a, if you want to use the class sort of analysis, we have the managerial or the ownership class against the labor, and, you know, we can clearly see who's getting the money. Right?
What about the menace of Walmart?
What about the menace of Walmart? Yeah, Walmart is a virulently anti-union, anti-labor company.
Should Safeway be supported in order to, should workers at Safeway be encouraged to take some kinds of, make less demands than they have made because of the menace of Walmart?
No, no, absolutely not. No, people should have access, and I wanted to get into this. People should have access to health care, and that is on demand, you know, as they need it. That is a basic human right, like food, like clothing, like shelter. If you're not healthy, you know, then what do you have? We need single payer system, and
oh, I agree with you.
When I got into these discussions with people who would want to engage me and want to find out what's going on, and many of them were rather conservative types who didn't support the strike, and they told me that. So I said, well, the problem here is, we don't have a healthcare system in this country that is accessible to everyone. It's a fine healthcare system if you can afford it.
Given that we don't have that system, though, do you feel that? Let me turn this back to Paul. Paul, what about the situation? Do you feel that you're feeling that the demands made on Safeway are too great around healthcare because of the other benefits being suggested as well?
Absolutely. I'm looking at the demands and total compensation, that X dollar per hour average figure, and I would leave it up to the employees to decide how much of that they'd like to spend on healthcare. But I would say that we cannot say that they're losing any ground economically as a group if their total compensation per hour on average is going up at the Consumer Price Index, and
Louis,
it is.
Your thought on that?
Well, they have lost ground if they're now having to pay a large monthly premium for their health care costs, which they previously didn't have to pay. You could see it as a tax, you know. It's a health care tax now that they're paying. You could, you know, that's a way to look at it. That they were no longer, previously weren't forced to bear that cost.
And it's moderated. I agree with you. And if we look, again, if we isolate health care, you know, if we believe that health care is off the top and not part of the compensation package, then you're right. But, again, I'm looking at the total story. And in that contract, the workers received, the current workers, actually, all the current workers have their full health insurance preserved. They took it all out on the new people who will come in the door, who are not yet union members and who are not yet there. So all the existing workers have preserved their health care for the first 2 years of the contract and may see a small contribution a small weekly contribution for family health care in the third year. But to offset all of that, they are also receiving, in a normal contract, they would receive a wage increase, and that wasn't done here. What the union chose was two lump sum bonus payments of 30 cents per hour worked, which works out to, I don't know, in the neighborhood of $600-$700 per year, and there are two of those payments, one in the first year and one in the second year for the existing workers. So again, when we look at the total compensation, if the total amount is keeping up with that CPI figure, then the expectation is that people will take some of the extra money they're getting and spend it on their healthcare contributions. We're not talking about raising their standard of living. We're talking about maintaining it. Raising it is a separate issue. And, you know, when you get into that, you have to make arguments about, you know, improved efficiency and, you know, more value for the work dollar. And
unless their work is already undervalued.
Exactly, yes, and that's also, you know, that's a possible argument. I would say that the work of the senior people, I mean, you've got folks here on the payroll who are earning $30 an hour in some situations, and in some cases in non-skilled positions, and then you have other folks earning $8.90 an hour, and I'd say that the injustice there is on the $8.90 side, not on the $30 side.
Mm-hmm. Comments on that, Lou?
It sounds as if, no, I'm not totally familiar with the terms of the contract that the workers finally agreed to. I've heard from various quarters that it was a bad contract. I mean, if they have a two-tiered system, that's bad right away, because that encourages the management to get rid of the older higher salaried workers and to bring in new people whom they will have to pay less.
Exactly, and they're counting on that. They've actually figured the attrition rate, and that's their benefit from the contract. And that's what, you know, that's what really bothers me. I want to close that gap so that everyone's earning more or less the same in the middle.
Oh, yeah. No, in many ways, I think the union betrayed its members with this contract. I think it's terrible.
But the argument really predates the contract because Paul's argument came out before the contract was settled and voted on and had to do with the demands. Problem is we're running a little bit out of time, and I want to slightly shift the focus here to what should be done in this upcoming strike. I mean, this last strike, I think you probably both agree, or maybe you don't, was pretty much of a failure, and it actually burdened the workers more than it benefited them. Or what's your sense on both of that briefly, Louis?
What should be done? Yes, as your analysis is right. I mean, I think the union blew it on the last strike. They didn't call immediately for a nationwide strike of Safeway and the other companies that colluded with them in sharing losses, which was judged to be illegal by the Attorney General of California, Bill Lockyer. He filed suit against Safeway and Ralph and Vons Pavilion for sharing losses. He said that is a violation of the antitrust.
May I ask you just quickly on that issue, whether it is also a violation for the UFCW to pool contributions from the 7 member locals serving the different geographies involved in the strike to create a pooled strike fund? I mean, it seems to me the same thing.
All 7 member locals, all one union, right?
Yeah, so why is that okay for the union if it's not okay for the employers?
You know, without getting into a larger discussion about labor laws in this country and how anti-labor labor laws are and pro-business, all I can say is the Attorney General of California determined that what Safeway had done was illegal, was a violation of the law. So, if you want to argue that workers don't have a right to organize and work together to improve their conditions, I don't know.
Well, he's arguing about pooling funds for one group but not pooling funds for the other. I don't know.
Well, you know,
that's a side issue. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
What should people in Santa Cruz listening to this broadcast do? What do you recommend? What do both of you guys recommend they do in this upcoming strike to guarantee victory for? I'm frankly more sympathetic with those workers who are paid less. What do you do there?
With the workers that are paid less.
What should we do? Those listeners in Free Radio now have an opportunity to get your prescription, Dr. LaFortune.
Am I being given a doctorate as well? Boy, these are being handed out like candy.
Doctor, can I get one too?
Yeah. Well, I'll call you. Well, we'll think about that.
What should people do? Well, they should certainly, and thank you, Robert, for doing this, because you're doing it. They should inform themselves on the issue. Find out what's going on in this country with labor, with health care, with affordability of health care. And they should find out about the attacks on labor by companies like Walmart, who are, as I said, as you know, virulently anti-union. They fire union organizers in their stores, anyone who makes a peep about that. I don't think there's a single Walmart store that has a union.
I think you're right, yeah.
So Walmart is a big problem, and that has to be talked about a lot.
But Walmart is not a big problem in Santa Cruz. What do we do in Santa Cruz is my question.
What do we do? Well, we organize. If there's going to be a strike, I would encourage people to support the strike, to come out on the picket line, talk to all your neighbors, explain to them why this is important, and also to advocate for a single-payer health care system in this country. Because that is really the companies, when the companies like Safeway realize that they can no longer do business, they can no longer compete with companies like Walmart, they will, because of health care costs, they will start putting pressure on the legislature to pass a single-payer health care system. It doesn't matter what you and I do, you know, the workers. We can scream and we can jump up and down as long as we want. When the companies, the people that own the politicians, go to them and say, look, we paid for your re-election campaign. We're dying out here because we can't afford to compete
with
Walmart.
I catch your drift, Lee, but I'm wondering exactly what you and I can do when the strike supports. I mean, I'm looking for particular things. You know, should homeless people come and set up encampments right outside the Safeway? Should people set up little crafts fairs around supporting? Should we start doing sew-ins to sew the garments for the workers? I mean, I'm looking at things that people can do in terms of direct action that might actually have both a dramatic visual and substantive effect to actually support them. You know, I saw you out there every week as I drove by to my card gaming session, doing picketing at the Morrissey Street Safeway, and I thought, why aren't I out there? But, you know, what's to be done next time? And let me ask Paul what's to be done, and then I'll go back to you. But we got to kind of wind this up. Go ahead.
Well, I agree on the single payer issue. I'm from Canada, so, you know, I'm used to single payer and a big supporter. And I would, you know, the quickest way for us to get that in this country is for General Motors or Ford or whoever to cancel employee benefits altogether. You'd have riots, and in a matter of days, you'd have a single payer healthcare system. End of discussion. The Band-Aid approach that employers are taking isn't moving us in that direction. The Band-Aid approach that governments are taking isn't moving us there either. It will be a bigger struggle.
What about the strike?
The strike. I would encourage people to inform themselves on both sides of the issue, and much of what I did in my article was to look at both sides and not come in with an assumption that the employer is all bad and that the workers are all good. The truth is always somewhere in the middle. So read materials from both sides, and that doesn't mean handouts you get when you go to the store. It doesn't mean handouts from Safeway, and it doesn't mean handouts from the Labor Council. It means going to the library. It means inquiring in the newspaper, doing searches on the web. You can go and read the actual contract offers and settlements online.
Grief. Who's going to have time to do any of this, Paul?
Well, so there are others. There are those of us here who are interested in reading the stuff and interpreting it in the form of articles. So when you read an article in the paper, ask yourself, have both sides been interviewed? Have both sides been consulted? Is the information credible? Then, what I think is important is to talk to the junior workers, and that's something I haven't done. I really don't know how you go in and insert yourself from outside, but focus on those new people who have been hired since October 6th when the strike started. Focus on the new people and ask them whether they feel that they have a decision-making voice in their union, and whether they feel that their union is representing them when it's agreeing to these settlements that in some cases have the junior workers earning one-third what the senior folks earn.
We're talking with Paul Marcelin Sampson and Louis LaFortune. Louis, how about I'll give you a minute conclusion here.
Well, as you know, just to reiterate, a major problem here is the anti-union labor laws in this country. We need to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act. As a Green Party activist, this is one of our major focuses is repealing Taft-Hartley. The Democrats and Republicans both support this anti-labor law. We need to institute single-payer health care. I would encourage everyone, and our Assemblyman John Laird is supporting this bill. It's SB 921. Sheila Kuehl of Santa Monica is the author, State Senator Sheila Kuehl. And it would institute a single-payer health care system in California. So that's something people can do. And as I said, John Laird has signed on as a co-author of this bill. So that's a good thing. If you don't live in Santa Cruz, contact your assemblyman. Contact Bruce McPherson, who's going to vote against it. But, you know, we should put pressure on him anyway.
So you can also go to www.santacruz.indymedia.org to get the Marcelin Sampson view, as well as some critics of his who respond, not on the length that you, however, present your case, Paul. Louis, while you're on the line, however, I want to shift to a different subject. Free Radio Santa Cruz, as you know, is seeking a new place to live.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking for a place. I'm going to go through this again for all you listeners out there who haven't yet gone out to find a place for us. We need our own entrance. We need access to a bathroom 24 hours a day. We need electricity, DSL compatible, got to be waterproof, secure, 100 square feet. We pay the rent and bills, and we give you 24-hour broadcasting. So why is it the Resource Center for Nonviolence isn't jumping on board here?
Well, what I've heard is that the board has been represented as objecting to the idea of having free radio in the building, not in the Resource Center building, but in the building next door, 511 Broadway. which is a sort of an apartment, you know, it's a shared housing situation.
We don't want them stinking gutter punks running around?
Well, there are offices in the basement. As you know, Earth First met down there for a long time. I don't know whether they still do. And there are other businesses that rent office space. So that was the proposed location, was in the basement of this building. There was some concern, I guess, from the board that this would not be appropriate to have free radio in there for various reasons, that it would disturb the renters, the residents who live upstairs. If people are of a mind, they could contact the board members of the Resource Center and ask them to reconsider.
Call Bob Fitch and ask him to change his conscientious objector's mind?
You could do that. Now, Bob Fitch is an employee of the Resource Center, and he's also oversees the management of that building.
He made the decision forwarded to the board, right?
That's what I understand. Mm-hmm. That's what I understand. So, but of course, he takes his instructions from the board.
Who's on the board?
Who's on the board? Well, I don't know everyone, but I do know Peter Klotz Chamberlain is a board member. I believe that Daryl Darling is a board member. You know, you could probably get all this information if you just go to rcnv.org. So Resource Center for Nonviolence, rcnv.org. And I'm sure they list the board members there on that website somewhere. And I would encourage people to call them and say, you know, what are your concerns? And we think it would be a great community service if you allowed free radio to set up shop in your business.
Huh. Yeah, I'm looking online here now, looking for the board of directors here. I see lots of nice quotes from Gandhi, Martin Luther King.
I don't think they're on the board.
I don't think so. Otherwise, why would they... be co-founded by someone who supports banning begging, Scott Kennedy. But,
yes. Now, if Scott is a co-founder, and I don't believe he's a board member, but I might be wrong.
I'm looking for volunteers. We've got information about volunteers.
That would certainly be something people could do.
I'm looking. I don't see their board clearly listed here. It may well be. It may well be here, kind of buried somewhere, but it's not clear. So that's something people can go to rcnv.org. You can call the Resource Center's phone number.
Yeah,
and lobby them to say you really commend the Resource Center for all their good work over the years, even though they haven't lifted a finger for homeless people while their council members have criminalized a lot of their activities in public.
Now, Robert, let us be careful about our approach.
Yes. Sorry, I have to add a little, you know, full disclosure here.
Yes. No, I know. No, you have a case. But let us not bite the hand that may presumptively feed us.
Right. Okay, right. Well, the phone number for the Resource Center is 423-1626 for all you Free Radio Santa Cruz folks who want to encourage them to give Free Radio Santa Cruz a chance. And, you know, I mean, the Resource Center, I don't know if any Resource Center members have a show on Free Radio. Maybe they think we're a little too grubby for their tastes. I know John Malkin has a show. I know he's been into nonviolence for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I've worked with them. You know, I mean, I enjoy working with the Resource Center people. They're committed.
Yeah, they're doing very important work as this war hysteria mounts, or I should say, as the determination to continue this occupation and the administration mounts against all odds.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen, Louis, I appreciate you.
This is one way people might want to present it is, you know, it's sort of a trial basis. You know, let us have like a month, 3 months or something. And mm-hmm. see how it works out, you know. And this would save Free Radio the pain and save our listeners the pain of having to be without Free Radio, because, you know, if we don't find a home, we're off the air.
We're homeless, as us other people are.
Right.
Listen, Louis, talking to Louis LaFortune, a Green Party activist, a peace activist, a labor activist, and also broadcaster on Free Radio 6:30 every Friday, mm-hmm. As long as we're on the air, at least until May 1st. Thanks for calling in and going toe-to-toe here with Paul Marcel and Samson. And, Paul, thank you. You're welcome to hang, Paul. Paul's in the studio.
Yeah, Louis, I wanted to ask if you could stay on the line and we could exchange contact information off the air.
Sure. I just want...
And that's about as much of the April 4th, 2004 show that survives. We kind of, I guess, there's time has taken its toll on some of this stuff, or... Perhaps I'll someday discover more complete archives and have the energy to put them up. But until then, that's what you get. As a consolation prize, because I think there may be more to this show than you've heard, you're about to hear a piece by Caitlin Johnstone. I played a piece last time. You can find her online, Caitlin, C-A-I-T-L-I-N, Johnstone, J-O-H-N-S-T-O-N-E. Mostly, I think she's on Patreon. They don't like her much on mainstream media, but you might find her occasionally there, or some of the older stuff. If you want to hear more, by the way, of what's going on in 2004, you can go into the Huff website, and you can find shows that happened before and after this show and give you some idea of what was going on at that time for all you historical buffs who want to go back and sort of sniff around there. But anyway, Caitlin Johnstone, I don't know, she probably was a toddler in those days, or a youngster anyway, or maybe an adolescent. But here's one of her pieces. They're just outright telling us that peace in Ukraine is not an option. Read by someone else, but still worth listening to.
They're just outright telling us that peace in Ukraine is not an option. U.S. Senator Joe Manchin said at the World Economic Forum on Monday that he opposes any kind of peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia. Manchin, who at the moment is one of the most powerful elected officials in Washington, added that only the complete forcible ejection of Russia from all of Ukraine is acceptable, that the war should ideally be used to remove Putin from power, and that he and the strategists he talks to see this war as an opportunity. I am totally committed as one person to seeing Ukraine to the end with a win, not basically with some kind of a treaty. I don't think that is where we are and where we should be, Manchin said. I mean basically moving Putin back to Russia and hopefully getting rid of Putin, Manchin added when asked what he meant by a win for Ukraine. Manchin clarified that he did not mean pushing Putin back to pre-February, ostensibly meaning with Russia still controlling the largely Moscow-loyal Crimea and supporting separatist territories in the Donbass, but with Kyiv fully reclaiming all parts of the nation. Oh no, I think Ukraine is determined to take their country back, Manchin said when asked to clarify, further clarifying that he wants his call for regime change in Russia to be carried out by, quote, the Russian people. I believe strongly that I have never seen, and the people I talk strategically to have never seen, an opportunity more than this to do what needs to be done, Manchin later added. And Ukraine has the determination to do it. We should have the commitment to support it. Manchin's comments fit perfectly with what we know about the U.S. centralized empire's real agendas in Ukraine. Earlier this month, Ukrainian media reported that UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson told the nation's President Volodymyr Zelensky on behalf of NATO powers that, quote, even if Ukraine is ready to sign some agreements on guarantees with Putin, they are not. Last month, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin acknowledged that the goal in this war is not peace in Ukraine or the mere military defeat of Russia, but to actually weaken Russia as a nation, saying, we want to see Russia weakened to the degree that it can't do the kinds of things that it has done in invading Ukraine. Last week, the New York Times reported that the Biden administration is developing plans to, quote, further choke Russia's oil revenues with the long-term goal of destroying the country's central role in the global energy economy. Just the other day, Ukraine's military intelligence chief announced that the mission has already creeped forward from the goal of defeating the Russian invaders to reclaiming the Crimean territory, which was annexed by the Russian Federation in 2014. 2 months ago, Biden himself acknowledged what the real game is here with an open call for a regime change, saying, for God's sake, this man cannot remain in power of Putin. Statements from the Biden administration, in fact, indicate that they expect this war to drag on for a long time, making it abundantly clear that a swift end to minimize the death and destruction is not just uninteresting but undesirable for the U.S. empire. This is not a proxy war with peace as an option anywhere within sight. It's not about saving Ukrainian lives. It's not even about beating Russia in Ukraine. It's about achieving regime change in Moscow, no matter how many lives need to be destroyed in the process. Peace is not on the menu. This war could easily have been prevented with a little diplomacy. As the University of Ottawa's Ivan Kachanovsky recently explained to the Maple, an agreement in which Ukraine promised to remain a neutral country and the fulfillment of the Minsk Accords could have stopped Putin's invasion. We knew now that the U.S. intelligence cartel had good visibility into what the Kremlin had planned for Ukraine, so they would have known exactly what could have been done to prevent the invasion. They knowingly chose to do none of those things, because the goal was to provoke this war the entire time and then weaponize it against Moscow. That's why the Biden administration has been hindering diplomatic efforts to negotiate an end to this war, why it has refused to provide Ukraine with any kind of diplomatic negotiating power regarding the possible rollbacks of sanctions and other U.S. measures to help secure peace, and why Washington's top diplomats have consistently been conspicuously absent from any kind of dialogue with their counterparts in Moscow. Empire spinmeisters and their propagandized victims like to claim that Ukrainian forces are fighting for peace in Ukraine. The other day, Kyiv Independent's Ilya Ponomarenko, who has called the neo-Nazi Azov Battalion his brothers-in-arms, tweeted this, quote, "Good God, I want peace in Ukraine by Christmas time. Fireworks and joy in the snowy streets of Kyiv, patriotic music, strangers hugging each other at the Maidan. Merry Christmas, war is over. That would be just awesome, don't you guys think so?" End quote. But anyone who understands this war knows this is ridiculous. Peace is not the goal in Ukraine. Most of the Ukrainians doing the fighting surely believe that they are fighting for peace in their homeland, and peace is surely their intention. But that's not something the Empire will allow if the Empire gets any say in the matter. Even if Ukraine does somehow avoid being used as cannon fodder to draw Moscow into a long and costly slog, as U.S. officials have admitted was done in both Afghanistan and Syria, and even if they do somehow manage to deliver a crushing and conclusive defeat to Moscow in the near term, which is far less probable than the Western media would have you believe, that wouldn't be the end of the war. The war would just change shape as the Empire and its proxies go on the offensive against Moscow. This war does not end with Russia being driven from Ukraine. It ends with regime change and the balkanization of the Russian Federation. Really, it doesn't end until the rise of China has been stopped and U.S. unipolar hegemony secured. Or when the Empire collapses. Or when we all die in a nuclear holocaust. All forward motion in this war has nothing but violence as far as the eye can see and its trajectory into the future. No matter how much wealth and war machinery you pour into this conflict, that trajectory of death and destruction will just keep stretching out to the horizon. As Chris Hedges recently explained, that's the only path the Empire has left open to itself. I've seen some cute kids in my time, but nobody's as adorable as people who think the U.S. pours weapons into foreign nations in order to achieve peace.